Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately Kathleen cannot be with us today. She sends her apologies, but we will normally be back next week with much more. Now, we are approaching the summer solstice, June 21st, 2010, which means we are about 30 months away from December 21st, 2012, that fated date in the Mayan calendar where even today I was reading a UK newspaper, there is still insinuations of fear and doomsday. But hidden amongst all of these doomsday prophecies, there is also something which says that crystal skulls are supposed to be coming together. And crystal skulls have been with us for a very long period of time, and it's a subject Kathleen and I will be getting back to over the next few weeks and months, because they are playing a very important role in both Kathleen and my life. Kathleen will tell, no doubt, her story of her love affair with a very beautiful crystal skull called Max. And today we are going to focus a bit on my love affair with another crystal skull, and it's just one of several, unfortunately or fortunately, love affairs I have with crystal skulls. But the one we are focusing on today is Mitchell Hedges, the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. And I have on the line a very dear friend of mine, Chris Winter, who is actually one of the principal reasons as to why I became more and more interested in the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. And probably Chris and I are going to explain as to how that happened. So Chris, welcome.
And thank you, Philip.
Chris, you about 20 years ago made radical changes in your life, and I'll let you enlarge upon it, but in short, you decided to abandon what I would call a very Western materialistic lifestyle, cast that all aside, literally jumped on a plane or a boat, and set yourself on a spiritual course, and a few days later, really, you ended up on the doorstep of Sammy Annie Anna Mitchell Hedges and the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. What happened?
Well, that was in June 1989. I suddenly found myself being catapulted out of, as you say, a westernized fast lane type of lifestyle into this other type of idea. I landed in America, rather in Canada, on the request of Anna to see her on a trip that I was doing around the world. She was living in Kitchener at the time, said to me, please come and see me, which I did. Ended up on her doorstep one Wednesday afternoon when she opened the door to me saying, my word, what a lucky boy you are. To which I replied, having got in, why was that? And she replied that usually Wednesday is an afternoon where she has an open house where people can come and see the crystal skull. And she said to me, you're the only person here. So sit down and enjoy what you've come to see.
And that's how you got your first experience of the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. And he didn't really let you go, did he?
No. From that very first moment, the two things really which really interested me was, one, the item itself, the actual crystal skull, because when I sat down, Anna said, would you like a cup of tea? And I said, yes. And she said, I'll go and make one. And she picked the skull up off the table, which was in front of me, and plonked it in my lap, and duly went off to make a cup of tea. What surprised me was two things. Was, one, that she did that, this very sacred object, and two, that the bottom jaw stayed on the plinth. I duly sort of turned it around in my hand. It's most a magnificent item, not really knowing my luck. And from that moment, the mystery of its being what it is, plus the fact is how it came into being and why. That really set me on the journey initially to look at crystal skulls. But as the journey continued, I became actually more interested in the man who actually brought it into light.
And we'll definitely jump onto the life and times of the great old Frederick like Mitchell Hedges. But just going back and kind of like painting the general framework of where Crystal Skull sits, and I think it's specifically relevant in light of this show, but also in light of just last week and the week before, once again reports about how the Smithsonian is saying that the Mitchell Hedges Crystal Skull is modern and hence apparently of no relevance. Of all the Crystal Skulls which are out there, there are several who are definitely of modern making, and there are some who are believed to be of ancient fabrication, whether that means they can be dated back to Mayan world, or if some people are to believe thousands, if not hundreds of thousands years older, some even go as far as to say that they're of an extraterrestrial origin. And the Mitchell Hedges one is very specific because, first of all, it's one of the few which has been quite detailed studied, and it's also the one of the few, the very few actually, which has a detachable jaw and which is so magnificent in its artwork that really, even if it is of modern fabrication, you kind of like wonder who made it and how it was made. So that is one aspect. What is your opinion about this controversy of modern versus old? Also, in light of the fact that you've actually been in contact and were there at the Smithsonian when some of this testing occurred.
We went across to see Bill Holman 2 years ago, before the Indiana Jones film actually came to light. And whilst we were there, Bill was given the opportunity, by request, his request, to take this crystal skull to the Smithsonian. He asked me, did I think that was a good idea? I actually said to him that I thought it was a bad idea because in the event of it being proved otherwise authentic, it would actually kill the myth and the mystery of it. However, we went along to the Smithsonian, met up with Jane Walsh, and we went through a vast amount of analytical type of investigation, including putting the skull under a microscope, a very powerful microscope. And there is no doubt that there are polishing marks on the surface of the crystal, which previously we had been led to believe that they weren't there before. That rather kills the myth, in a way, in having actually been there and seen it. It rather took away my breath to say everything that I thought that I had believed in had actually been taken away. But that does not prove anything, really, because in the end, I had to ask myself, could they have been a civilization whose technology had that ability to create crystal and to create the actual Mitchell Hedges crystal?
And just to interject, I'm always reminded of the words of Michael Coe, who was one of the greatest Mayan scholars, and at some point in his life, and I think actually because of a documentary on crystal skulls, somebody asked him about these tool marks which were on crystal skulls, and his comment is so interesting. He just said, like, basically that the likes of Jane Walsh, these people who said that Mayans did not have any instruments, actually had no idea about what the Mayans had and what the Mayans didn't have. And he had a complete disrespect for, again, the likes of Jane Walsh, who felt that somehow the presence of tool marks somehow meant that they couldn't be of Mayan artifacts. So the other thing is also that, if I remember, in the 1950s, it's known that Frank Dorland worked on the Mitchell Hedges skull and worked on it quite extensively, and I believe also with modern tools to kind of analyze and or restore it. So is it possible that the tool marks are from him, is another question.
Absolutely. We don't know what sort of Anna gave the skull to Dorland for two reasons. One was to authenticate it, and two, that possibly that she actually wanted to sell it. We don't know what Dorland actually did in his what we would term as restoration work on the skull. We really don't know. But it is possible that he could have, if he felt that it needed polishing, to use some abrasive type of material on it. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Now, going from the skull to the man behind the skull, Mike Mitchell Hedges, and this is really where we met. I remember sitting at a conference, or actually standing at a conference, and you began to relate a most dramatic and interesting story to me, which was very critical of the publicly accepted story of Anna, which I will let you tell. And then kind of like the other story of Mike, which you discovered along your research. So please go ahead and tell that.
Are you referring to the time when you met up with Ambrose Bierce?
Exactly.
Okay. One thing, I was extremely interested in Mitchell Hedges and how he followed a line of investigation and why he followed that line of investigation. This really came about in reading everything about him. And to really get into his personality, you have to sort of do a character assassination, really, on his life, take the whole thing apart, and find out what his driving motivation is. His motivation was really to discover the idea that there had existed in some time, or rather, a civilization whose technology was as good as ours, if not better. In 1913, Mitchell Hedges was in New Orleans. He was to make the crossing into Mexico to do what? I don't know. But at the same time, there was another man who was actually in New Orleans at the time, called Ambrose Bierce. Now, Ambrose Bierce was an occultist. He was a follower of mystery and things like that. Ambrose Bierce went over into Mexico and joined up with Pancho Villa. Also, Mitchell Hedges went over into Mexico and also got captured by Pancho Villa. Now, there is no earthly reason why these two men, who were basically Westerners, would not have met each other. But both these men were also following their own paths. But they were also actually following the same path. And in my feelings, that they actually teamed up together and possibly underwent a trip of their own to go and discover something.
And what's that something?
Well, this is my own speculation, I have to say now. Because of Ambrose Bierce's background and because of Mitchell Hedges' background, I think that they were entrusted by some people into a secret. Call it a universal secret, where they were both people that these people could entrust the secret to, which is Ambrose Bierce and Mitchell Hedges. And my feelings are, is that both Ambrose Bierce and Mitchell Hedges underwent a ceremony. After the ceremony, they were taken to what I would consider a treasure. And in that treasure were what Mitchell Hedges describes in his book as in White Tiger as crystal heads. Now, something very peculiar happens after this particular encounter. One is Ambrose Bierce disappears totally off the face of the earth. And Mitchell Hedges, in 1913, then decides after that to come back to the UK. Now, no mention is ever mentioned of this encounter with these two people. We can't say that Ambrose Bierce never... We don't know if Ambrose Bierce ever mentioned it, because there's no record of it. But Mitchell Hedges went on to live to 1959, and he never mentioned it. But the likelihood of this happening, and this happening to these people, an experience which they couldn't explain, is more than likely. And it is actually brought out in Mitchell Hedges' book, White Tiger. There's two chapters. One is called The City of the Gods. It's called The Lost City. And the other chapter is called The Aztec Treasure. And in it, he describes going through this ceremony and seeing the treasure.
And kind of for people who are listening, most of them are obviously extremely well aware of what Kathleen does, which is use fiction to use historical truths. Now, when you look and read White Tiger, what you're confronted with is a story of an Englishman who somehow ends up in Central America, is taken in by a local tribe, is then somewhat made their chief, and as part, as you were explaining, as part of this chief making rituals, he's then shown a treasure which that group of Indians is protecting, and he's led into an underground cave system, and he describes how after a series of magical events, including what appear to be walls which when they are touched somehow appear to be doors and open up, and that he is led into the treasure, which seems to be the treasure of the Mayans, and that this treasure contained various things, but also including crystal heads. So I guess the logical conclusion is that somehow the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull might be one of those crystal heads, and that Mitchell Hedges himself could not really relate the story in an autobiography, or could somehow, you know, write it into non-fiction, but that he used fiction. And for what I find interesting about White Tiger is this, that when you look at the accepted timeline, which is something which the skeptics love doing, because timelines for skeptics is like the Holy Grail, as if a timeline is able to explain everything. And the timeline is this, that in the 1940s, it's known that the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull goes up for auction at Sotheby's. There's a photograph in the auction catalogue. You yourself have done tremendous work in actually tracing down this auction catalogue and finding out that this is the case. And for the skeptics, this is all they need. It's that Mitchell Hedges bought it. But this is the 1940s, and there are definitely indications that he had a crystal skull with him before, but specifically White Tiger dates back to 1931, which is a full decade before the Sotheby's auction catalogue. So have you got anything more to kind of like add to this period, or kind of like your experiences with the skeptics on this all too easy quip of dismissing something which is far more interesting and by default far more important?
Well, Mitchell Hedges we know the book was printed, published in 1931, but it would have been a book that he would have been writing for years before. I mean, several years before. It wouldn't have just come out of the blue. He would have most probably been writing the book for about 5 years, and the book does, it does cover a lot of the type of personality he is. He seems to be in the book and in himself at a sort of a quandary that he's trying to tell us something, which he can't tell us if it was in a book of fact, because he couldn't prove it. And Mitchell Hedges was trying to be as authentic as he could be to the academic world without being one of these people who would be labeled as crazy. So my feeling, Phillips, is that Philip, I think he knew back in the UK, because about that time, just after that, the what was known as the Burney skull from the Burney Collection skull came up for being looked at by, I forgot the name of the magazine now, you have to help me with that. Was it Mankind?
I think it is indeed Mankind, yes.
Yeah, it was looked at in Mankind. It was compared to the skull that was actually in the British Museum. From that point of view, there was a skull known, but nothing had actually come to light until 1933. Now, when Mitchell Hedges knew about that, I think he became very interested in trying to acquire that skull. And when it came up to auction, as Anna said, my father was really quite angry because it was his skull. Well, the story goes that it actually was lent to Burney as part of a security on a loan, and he dashed up to London to go and acquire it back.
So we are in the 1950s, and crystal skulls began to kind of get some reputation, but really it's only in the 1980s that they became more prominent. And actually, before kind of like doing the timeline and bringing it to the present, in the 1980s, one of the first really explorers, again, who goes in search of crystal skulls was a person called Nick Nocerino. And I remember how he has gone on the record that when he was traveling in Central America, he was contacted by local Indian tribes who also were offering their crystal skulls to him. And in that moment in time, they were actually offering him these skulls for sale, because they knew that by selling him these skulls, with the money they received for it, they could maintain the village specifically buying medication and kind of other goods which they were in need of for several months, if not years. Mm-hmm. And Nick Nocerino said that he always declined such offers because there were various reasons for it, but one of them was that he didn't want such a trade to occur because he felt that these crystal skulls were part of Central America's heritage. Now, in the 1980s, the Mitchell Hedges skull became the subject of a book. More crystal skulls began to appear. You began to become interested in the subject as well. A few years ago, as you said, in 2008, there was the big Indiana Jones movie, which has really put crystal skulls on the forefront of everybody's mind with numerous documentaries. After all of this year, after two decades of your research, what are crystal skulls to you, and why can't they let you go? Because I know for a fact that you've been trying to, on occasion, run from them screaming, but they don't seem to be willing to let go.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, after the Indiana Jones film came out, I looked at the film. Actually, I got a copy later on in the year of the DVD, and I actually looked at the timeline, or should we say the script line of the film, to see what the correlations were between Mitchell Hedges, the Crystal Skulls, and the fictitious film script. I did a sort of almost a second by second analysis of the film versus the Mitchell Hedges, and came up with the idea that there were something like over 50 correlations of similarities between the film and the Mitchell Hedges life. So although Indiana Jones is, from Spielberg Lucas' side, will have nothing to do with the Mitchell Hedges, he is mentioned in the film twice, saying this is not the Mitchell Hedges skull. But nevertheless, we are still dealing with skulls and crystals. They use the idea that the I think when they actually, the skulls do come together at the end of the film, they're not 13 skulls, they're actually 12. But the 12 go into one, which actually becomes the 13th. So there is an awful lot of truth in all this, which is all dressed up in fiction. And my feeling is, what are they trying to tell us? That's the big thing. What are they trying to tell us?
And what do you think they're trying to tell us? And what do you think needs to be told as well?
Well, this is why I have to cross the line of going from the insanity into total madness.
This show is called The Spirit Revolution for something, Chris.
Say again?
I said this show is called The Spirit Revolution for something, Chris.
Right, okay. Well, I've always felt actually there's more than 13 skulls. I feel that is because we're only dealing with one side of a puzzle. They are just like you get 13 disciples round a central point. You get 13 skulls, which you can call them as male attendants. You can get 12 skulls round another point, which is a female. And when you actually link these two fields of influence together, and you lock them together, which they are locked already, you can't unlock them, they are already locked, you get the drawing of the vesica, or the two circles intersecting each other, making the vesica passer in the middle. And this is where you see the Christ figure is always portrayed, in the middle, which means I am the light. So you've got two invisible fields of energy, which when they're spun up and in total equilibrium become the diamond light, which actually becomes the rainbows of light. One skull on its own is no good. Even two on their own are no good. You have to have the complete amount of crystals and to be able to put them on a circuit diagram and then fire up the circuit diagram. And that's what I think we're going towards.
just stepping briefly into the shoes of Kathleen. In the Book of Love, Kathleen highlights certain aspects to do with what you would call the center of the Vesa Capaces and the way where Jesus is always depicted. And she links this specifically with the blue light and how this blue light is very important, and how this is linked to the idea of conscious conception, which is also a subject which she has carried over in her most recent The Poet Prince. Mm. So before I go on, do you see a connection there as well?
Very interesting you mentioned the blue light, because the blue light is to do with life. It's the colour that... it's the colour that you see in the auric field of a lot. It's life itself is the colour blue.
And of course, kind of going back into what we know about the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull is this: that a very good friend of mine and yours as well is Dr. Harry Oldfield, and by coincidence and by design. When you and I decided to put Mitchell Hedges' Crystal Skull on public exhibition in November of 2008 in Edinburgh, two things happened. First of all, about 1,000 people on a Sunday came and watched this, and to me it was a revelation as to how people interacted with this. Some people just came to take a photograph of it, and that was all they really needed. Other people were curious, were interested, but some people came and were completely blown away by this. And I remember you saying, because you were managing the crowds downstairs, that some people just left and had no idea where they had parked their car or even whether they had come by car. Now, throughout this exhibit, we had Dr. Harry Oldfield's special cameras, PIP photography, and all of that stuff, which is too complex to go into, so we'll just name it and get on with it. But basically what he does is, when you take a photograph, what we see through our eyes is a very limited aspect of light. Light is far more complex than what we can see and what normal cameras are interested in registering. And he has come up with techniques to actually map and visualize other particles of light, specifically photons. And so PIP is basically that. It's photons which have been made visible. And the very first time he let this type of technology loose on the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull was during the Nexus conference, I think in early 2008, in October 2008 or thereabouts. And what he did was, during a meditation, which Bill Holman, the current caretaker of the crystal skull, was doing, he had, from the back of the audience, where there were about 400 people, he had a camera with PIP photography running, focused on the Mitchell Hedges skull up front, and then you could see the audience as well. And he saw how, during meditation, a beam of energy came out of the crystal skull, went through the audience and went into some people and then out, but also didn't go into some people. It kind of bypassed certain people and it had an effect on certain people. And then this energy went back into the crystal skull. Now, upon analysis, what he found was that those who this kind of energy went through were actually meditating. They were the ones who were following the instructions and were in this meditative mood. The ones where it had no effect on were the ones who were just there as tourists and spectators. They were there to watch the spectacle, but weren't interacting. What we saw, what he then did in a more private session was that he hooked up some other machinery to the crystal skull. And Harry is a brilliant mind. He's this literally the crazy scientist. And I don't know how he got this idea. Maybe we need to get him on the show and he can explain this to us. But he had the idea to hook up a device which reads brainwaves, and which normally you should only use on people because people have brainwaves. Objects do not have brainwaves. Yet he hooked up this device to the crystal skull and actually found out that, and I think I might be slightly wrong, but I think I'm getting the gist of his conclusions right, which is that even though the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull did not behave like an ordinary human brainwave, that he was registering things happening within the crystal skull which an inanimate object, which in essence is the crystal skull, is shouldn't be registering. So his machinery was mapping the fact that there was something more going on. So with all that and all that having said, he came to Edinburgh, and on the Sunday when the skull was on public display, he put his PIP photography on the crystal skull, and we mapped it for an entire day and projected it onto a camera. And what he became fascinated by was that during the day, from the very top of the crystal skull, a very tiny beam of you can't call it light, because again we can't see it, but the PIP photography visualizes it as light, so I guess it is still light, invisible light, kind of like sometimes went completely off screen, really kind of like, no, as if it was uplinking something to something in outer space. And then at other times, it was just hovering about 5 inches or so, sometimes even slightly less, above the top of the crystal skull, as if the download or the upload or whatever it was kind of like not happening at that moment in time. So an awful lot of things have been happening on this idea. Now, when we map Harry Oldfield's observations to what you're saying about crystal skulls and the fact that that when they're all together they create this, you're obviously convinced that crystal skulls are not just a little joke by people in Africa or in Brazil, and that there is a real power to these crystal skulls. So the next question then is, what are the crystal skulls here to do, or what are they here to teach us, or what is it all about?
Can I just do something on the back of what you were just saying with about Harry Oldfield?
Of course.
One of the things I noticed actually in this, when we were doing the Histories and Mysteries conference, is that when you had somebody in the room that was actually tuning into the same frequency, then an activation seemed to happen. This is when we got people coming downstairs and who were just totally blown away. We also had people coming who actually couldn't even go into the room. We had one woman that made 3 attempts to try and go into the room, and she just met this massive sort of energy field, and she was having a real hard time. But to come back to your question, Philip, what are they here to teach us? That's a very difficult question to answer. I think when we come into a cognizance of what crystal is and how the makeup of everything that's going on, we begin to understand that that there have been civilizations before us who have laid down certain technological things which breach time-space. My own feelings is that when you actually put all these crystals together and you tune them up, and really they are basically what I would call 12 pairs. You've got 12 pairs of male-female in their respective colors. You have two centers, which is a black and a white, which is the divine pair. You put them all together, and you create what I would call the holographic temple of light. The holographic temple of light would be rather like looking at a floor plan of some of the round temples of old. Now, within these temples, it's not that they teach us anything, but rather that when you're in these temples, whatever question you put is you get your answer. This is why crystals are so revered around the world, because people say, it's actually giving me knowledge. In a way, it is, but the knowledge is not necessarily coming from the crystal. It's coming from your own crystal self. And it's the ability to retune you back into yourself.
Now, one of the other things which I have been greatly intrigued with, and it's something of a sidestep, but I also think it's relevant. You told me, which I didn't know at the time, that certain very powerful places, like for example, the island of Iona in off the coast of Western Scotland, is really a place on Earth where I'm slightly exaggerating here, but I don't think I am that much, that you're really walking on crystals there, which are practically on the surface.
Oh, yes. Iona, actually, is a geological treasure trove for people who coming from all over the world who studied geology, because the rocks there, there's some of the rocks there were at one time the oldest rocks in the world. Iona, as was also, had a name. It was called the First Breath of God, and it was the first landmass that actually broke from the waters. In other words, it was birthed from the water. It was the first land fall, because the rocks are so old. The reason why they know the rocks are so old, because there is no organic chemistry in the rock, like shells or bones or whatever. It is just pure rock, and was actually known as the first breath of God.
And this is, I think, extremely interesting, because Iona is, you know, for people who do not know it, it is one of the most sacred isles in Christianity. It is a place where basically one of the cradles of Christianity, mm-hmm. Very sacred also to the Celts, and specifically the Chaldees, which is a form of Christianity which was wiped out which officially lost out in the Synod of Whitby, which I think happened in 450 AD, when it was decided that the Chaldees and various other forms of early Christianity would no longer be followed. And one of the powerhouses of the Chaldees, and one of the places which the followers of St. Patrick did, was Iona. And Iona remains a very powerful and magnetic place. So, tying this all back to the concept of crystal, when the crystal skull phenomena began in the 1980s, you had, I think her name was Carol Watson, who put her hands on the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull and began to channel various information. We know that in our daily technology, which we use, whether it's computers or televisions or anything, we use sand and crystal to store information. Is this the kind of thing we need to be accepting, that this is what is happening with these crystal skulls, that they are containers in this respect, or is it actually far more complex than how am I explaining it?
Bearing in mind that the human body is a crystal anyway, and we are touching a crystal, if we get into the harmony of that, we don't see any difference between what we're touching and ourselves, then we link into a greater aspect of truth and to knowledge. It's how we interpret that knowledge. Carol Wilson was actually extremely good. I mean, I've watched her work with the crystal skull when we took the green stone over. She was able to work with the skull in bringing out of herself a sort of understanding of reality, which was extremely abstract, very unemotional and very matter-of-fact. Her ability was really quite frightening, in fact, in a way, because she actually, when you watch her working with it, it becomes very, not very easily understood, put it that way.
Backtracking slightly, you said our bodies are a crystal. Now, I've always been told that we are pretty much 70 or 90% water, and I've never been told that we are a crystal. So can you expand a tiny bit about that?
Well, if you look at the body, I mean, the body is made up of elements, water. I mean, if you take water and freeze it, it's a crystal. If you take the blood and look at it under a microscope, it's liquid crystal. The body is really a breakdown, although we can call it organic, is really a breakdown of natural elements which are put in a certain order that makes up the human body. In that body flows liquid, which we call blood. It has a mind, which it can think and create reality. So we really are just a big bag of liquidized crystal in a lot of ways. But if you think that this bag of liquidized crystal is holding this telephone and talking to you, it becomes even more bizarre, because we then look at the human body not as a sort of more of a tool rather than a piece of, a thing with a name. It's rather like, instead of looking at the car, you look actually inside the car as to who's driving the car. Most of us look at the car, but don't look through the windows to see the driver. And the driver is the liquid crystal inside which is driving the car. In fact, the liquid crystal actually created the car as well. So the liquid crystal is actually creating the objects in which it lives to enact out a reality. The human body actually becomes, I'm very sorry to put it this way, a tool.
What you're explaining there is very much along the lines of Michael Talbot, who was one of the people who promoted the concept of a holographic universe, and he used quantum physics at two levels. First of all, quantum physics says that thought literally creates this universe, that we are in charge of deciding the outcome of certain things, which how reality is, and that quite a bit of reality is basically just accepted thought, i.e. custom habit. Mm. But he then actually said that the way reality was built and projected onto our brain was actually very much like a holograph, and he has written an excellent book, which I actually think is called The Holographic Universe, and his name is Michael Talbot. Unfortunately, he died shortly after publishing this book in 1993, I think. But it's back to that concept of kind of like a quantum physical approach, which I've always felt is also the way ancient religions like these ancient Egyptians have actually appreciated this, and very much how magic is really at its core, which brings me back to a twofold question. We have crystal skulls. Some of them are of modern origin. Some of them are likely to be of ancient origin. We see these crystal skulls on display. Thousands, if not millions of us, either have one or go and visit some at some point in their life or are confronted with one. You said that somehow these skulls are going to get together. So what's in store for the future, and what is the message to listeners and basically everybody who's either interested or who's not interested in crystal skulls as to what kind of part of reality or society crystal skulls are occupying and or should be occupying?
The thing about the skulls coming together, I don't necessarily think, Philip, that the current skulls are coming together. I hope this doesn't sound taking the present skulls that we see everywhere down a notch to two, but the skulls that I would refer to coming together are of such purity that they could only, those and only those skulls could work and do the work that is necessary for them to do. It is rather like if you have all the pieces to make a television set, but somebody has got pieces which are not going to work in that set, so we can't use them. It's the skulls that would come together would be known to the people who would actually know what to do with them and how to use them. But I don't feel, although I've been with the Mitchell Hedges skull for the last 20 years, I never felt it was an absolute, I never felt it was really the skull or a part of the skulls. It just had too many inclusions in it to be perfect, to be used for the purpose that the skulls would be useful. What I'm saying by this is if you were to see the real ones, and you can see the ones that are presently known to us, you wouldn't even consider the ones that are known to us as to be genuine. And I apologize to anybody if that sounds as a put-down, but it's not. What we see today is the remembrance, and they're almost like souvenirs to remind us of something. So it would, seeing these things, do remind us of things, and it does, as we saw in the Histories and Mysteries exhibition conference we did, the amount of people, there were a lot of people who thought it was a very beautiful thing, and that was it. But there were some people who were really taken by it. And they've gone off on their own journeys to undergo whatever process they need to undergo. As you've mentioned, the work of Harry Oldfield's work shows us that crystal is not just an inanimate substance, it's a living substance, just like we are. And by putting this whole thing together, when the time comes, my goodness me, and how do we define the word when? I just don't know. All I know is, I can say, is I don't feel that what we have is the genuine articles yet.
But at the same time, you are saying that because they are made of crystal, they do have an effect on people, and that actually, how should I put this, that it is more the crystal rather than the crystal skull, which is empowering, changing, or to put it broader, fascinating people.
Yes. For instance, I mean, for me, the crystal, coming in touch with Anna, the crystal skull, and the life of Mitchell Hedges, was more, for me, was a wake-up call. It reminded me of something I knew, and that's why I went on the journey, the long journey, to investigate, firstly, the crystal skull, but then more for the why Mitchell Hedges was so taken by wanting to discover this civilization whose technology was incredible. But to reiterate this thing is, a lot of these skulls are reminding us somewhere in somebody's psyche. It's a wake up thing. They say, because they're in a space where they're looking for something, a piece of information which will help them to do something, which could be a future event in the world yet to happen. So they're getting the wake up call. Not everybody's getting the wake up call. But they, specific people, are getting wake-up calls.
And I think it's interesting putting your example there, but also Mike Mitchell Hedges' one. As you said, he was an adventurer. He had things happen to him whereby, I think it's right to say that he began to realize that reality was far more complex and far more interesting than even he thought at one point when he set out on his quite boyish adventures of catching gigantic fish and gigantic lobsters and all of that thing, which he is also known for. He did a tremendous amount of research trying to uncover civilizations. And when he was writing, there was very little known about the Mayan civilization, and anything which was pre-Mayan was considered, and definitely labeled at that time, as Atlantis. And he wrote quite a bit about Atlantis and was fascinated by the fact that there was a pre-Mayan civilization. And I think it's something to his credit that he contributed to that, and that he's actually been proven right, as we now will know. But it shouldn't be taken for granted at that moment in time that what he was saying would later be proven right. And the other aspect of that is that he collected a gigantic collection of artifacts, which he then later gave to various museums, including the British Museum.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mitchell Hedges seemed to have in his possession throughout his life the most incredible treasures. I think the most notable one was the Black Virgin of Kazan, which came out of Russia in 1917. I mean, that was one of the biggest treasures to be returned to Russia. I think it was in 2006, I think it was. Because it was something that, because there was a legend with that icon, that when it actually went back to Russia, it would be heralding a new era, which is partially true, I suppose.
Well, yes, and just to briefly fill in the listeners on the story of the Virgin of Kazan, because I think it begins to highlight the fact that with Mitchell Hedges, we're actually documenting a spirit revolutionary rather than as some people try to depict him as a charlatan. What happened with the Virgin of Kazan is that it was that. He was the original, he wasn't maybe the original Indiana Jones, but he was a Indiana Jones in the sense that he came somehow in the possession of all of these artifacts. And one of them was the Virgin of Kazan, which is a Russian icon portraying the Virgin Mary, which was miraculously found, I think, in the 17th or 16th century in Russia, and became extremely treasured by the Russian people. It was believed that those who held it would literally rule and safeguard the Union of Russia. And it is known that quite often when Russia went to war, the king and or priests would walk with this icon in front of the troops to bless the troops and to tell and inspire the troops that they were protected by the Virgin and her divine power herself. Mm. And what happened at the time of the Russian Revolution in 1917 is that, just like what happened in the French Revolution, is that all the churches were attacked and the greatest Russian icon, the Virgin of Kazan, got lost. And for very many years, a few decades, it was unknown what happened, and some people actually thought it was destroyed until it was identified in an antique shop in the UK, from where Mitchell Hedges actually went and bought it, and then began a very long and complicated series of negotiations with the Russian people, specifically Russian exiles at the time, in trying to return the Virgin of Kazan to Russia. The sale in the end didn't happen, but the Russian exile people did get it into their possession, and in the 1990s, shortly after the Fatima, shortly after Pope John Paul II had survived Fatima and became aware of the Virgin of Kazan's existence, that it was actually transferred to his own private headquarters. And then, as you say, in 2006, the Vatican returned it back to the people of Russia. And I think we're right in saying that definitely this was a life and an age-changing feature, because Anna definitely made it clear that she and likely her father never wanted to see returned to Russia or the Soviet Union under communist regime, and that definitely never happened.
Mm. I mean, there was in fact, the skull, just coming back to the skull, because it's all part of a talisman idea, there were so many talismans which came through his life which he felt had to go back to their original source. I mean, the Black Virgin was one. The crystal skull was another. The story goes that Anna told me is that he did actually hand, when the skull was actually found in 1924, he had it in his possession for a while, but then he handed it back to the Maya. But then the Maya handed it back to him to say, please go into the world and tell them what is happening to our people. And that's how he was really just a custodian of the skull, but I never really felt that he actually owned it. But that's another story, because that then sort of contradicts the story about him buying the skull at an auction sale in 1943.
But to some extent, the underlying story, I think, which is something which Mitchell Hedges really understood, is that the real power, if you want, lies with people, and the real awakening lies with people. And whether it's a Virgin of Kazan or another relic or a crystal skull, really what it does, and you used the word during the interview as well, it's a gimmick, it's an object which allows people to awaken. But really, the real power and the real phenomenon is inside of us. It's not anywhere else.
Yeah, the one thing about the Virgin of Kazan, the story is that when Napoleon was in Moscow, the Virgin was taken out of its hiding place, and it was paraded in front of the Russian people and the Russian army. And from that, they got the courage and the strength to turn around and push the French and Napoleon out of Moscow. It was that it had such a formidable force and a realization that it was a focus. That this thing, people needed a focus, a need, something to react to, something to lay their lives down for. And that's what they did. They pushed Napoleon out of Russia, into the Russian winter. And we know what happened to the army on its way back to France. It perished. And they can have that amount of force for you to push yourself beyond your own capabilities. And I think, in a way, the emergence of crystal skulls in our psyche and our consciousness to certain people is doing the same thing. It's making them realize that there is something much greater than themselves. And what is this greater than self? It really, in the end, comes back to self, the observer.
And we're reaching the end of the interview as well. But it's clear that you know, Mitchell Hedges knew this. It's clear that you have seen this happen to people. And to a large extent, it's also, I think, what you experienced along the way about yourself, isn't it? That really, as time progressed, the skull becomes less important. But the effect of the skull, so to speak, is the real mystery and is the real power, which we cannot go into here, but which maybe we need to go into a bit later. Mm. What would you say to that journey, kind of like this journey of going beyond the crystal skull?
It's a journey into self. It's a journey, well, I think it's summed up very nicely at the end of the film, Indiana Jones, when, for anybody who's seen it, when the spaceship leaves and goes into space and the people are left on top of this mountain, and Indiana Jones says to everybody, the treasure is not gold, it is knowledge. And the greatest knowledge you can have is who are you?
And I hope that in the first exposure that the spiritual revolution has had to crystal skulls, we have begun to touch that answer and have set people on their way. Chris, it was a delight and an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I hope we will be talking at some point in the future on the show again. From Kathleen and me, this was another episode of The Spirit Revolution. We hope to hear you next week. Until that time, the truth against the world.